efficient? And the answer almost always is no, because the energy is not in the hydrogen. The energy is in the free hydrogen molecule bonds. And you only get that if you free it from the metal, which requires energy. So you put energy in, you get a little bit less energy out, and at the end of the day, you haven't accomplished much of anything but just transported energy from one place to another. You haven't really, metal hydride that's considered by some people to be storing hydrogen is basically the same as the water that's holding hydrogen. Without the necessary energy that's going to be greater than the energy extracted from the hydrogen, you're stuck with an inert material.
Okay, thank you very much for that explanation. I wonder if anybody else can add to the subject. Okay. So the next one we have Faraday paradox. Actually, not one, two of them. So I sent to Dr. Roy the email, can the Faraday paradox be solved? Because there was kind of a humoristic statement. The Faraday paradox described by Rufy Sam. Michael Faraday in 19th century refers to two distinct phenomena. So we're not dealing with one, we're dealing with two paradoxes. The first is related to electromagnetism and involves a circuit that is seemingly defies Faraday's law of induction. However, we look closer, it is revealed that the circuit is made of, consists of two interconnected loops rather than a simple wire loop resolving the paradox. And I would appreciate Dr. Roy's comment on it. And the second one is electrochemical paradox. So that would be in area of our PhD is here right now. So it was observed that in the reaction between nitric acid and the steel, Faraday found that diluted nitric acid corrodes steel, while concentrated nitric acid does not. So maybe for the first one, the electromagnetism, Dr. Roy.
C2GS. Well, I got to tell you, Wesley, I don't know for the life of me how to explain it to someone who hasn't seen the videos. I mean, the people who are familiar with Faraday's paradox probably would know what I was talking about, but anyone else wouldn't have the vaguest idea what I was alluding to. So it's a very difficult, more than a few times, a difficult subject to kind of fully explain over the air without the sake of actually illustrations of what homopolar motors and all those things that go bump in the night are designed like, to understand where the voltage potential might be sneaking into the equation.
Well, instead of explaining the video and what was in the video, I would just make a one sentence. I'm unfortunate to describe it properly. The electromagnetism-based Faraday paradox is resolved by recognizing the circuit loop topology comprising two interconnected loops. And that would be true. But going into all of it would really be difficult. Back to you.
Okay, but again, if you don't already know what these things look like, you don't know what those loops are. The loops are stationary objects that are part of the circuit connected to a galvanometer. So you have two possible rotating objects. You have an aluminum disc, and you have a permanent toroidal mass. magnet. And the experiment is where you rotate one or the other or both, and then you measure the galvanic voltage potential difference between the rotor and the edge of the aluminum disc based on a pair of brush connected wires feeding into the galvanometer. And the magic apparently is that the voltage potentials are not established by the rotating aluminum disc or the toroidal magnet, but by the actions of those on the two straps of wire that are stationary and non-moving and connected to the galvanometer that's reading the voltage potential difference. And apparently there are some experiments where they manipulate those connections to be in line with the magnetic flux lines that are predicted, and demonstrates that they can screw around with the voltage potential because it's those stationary parts, not the rotating parts, that are the important thing in the voltage difference. But if you don't know what any of this looks like to begin with, you probably don't know what I'm talking about.
I agree with you, but if we talk about the second one, I think it would be much easier. So the second Faraday paradox, electrochemical paradox. So we have a nitric acid and a steel. And Faraday found that diluted nitric acid corrodes steel, while concentrated nitric acid does not. Of course, both of the paradoxes were solved, but we have our PhD in chemistry here right now, so if you could, if two of you, you could give you a few 5 cents into the story, please. Dr. Roy.
I just have a bachelor's degree in chemistry. I think our PhD may not even be with us tonight. And I didn't even notice that part of the question. I got to go back into my email and look it up again, because I thought it was solely related to that homopolar generator puzzle paradox. I didn't even read the one about the nitric acids.
Oh, VDH with a shot at it?
Certainly, John.
I think when an acid is diluted, well, like take nitric acid. Pure nitric acid, when it ionizes, you get hydrogen ions, H plus, and the NO3 radical when it ionizes. Now, when you add water to it and dilute it, I think instead of hydrogen ions, as when the acid ionizes, you get something called a hydronium ion, which I think is H3O plus. That might be more reactive as far as causing corrosion than just the pure hydrogen ions that you might see in, pure nitric acid. Just a guess.
Okay, I mean, I don't know. I have a little problem with that. I don't think the purest nitric acid you could make is non-aqueous. So I think there's inherently hydronium ions in the solution. The whole nature of measuring pHs is not measuring hydrogen, but measuring hydronium. It's the negative logarithm of I think hydronium ion concentration. That give you the pH scale. I'm not quite sure. I think there's hydronium in there as well, but it's possible that given enough dilution, there's some other side reactions that things are capable of.
That's why I didn't include the second paradox in my email to you. I'm sorry. said, it was kind of an enigma. Nothing special. Both of paradoxes were solved. I'm extremely interested with history. So when I look at some manufacturing, I look at their history with the how they appear 200 years ago, how they do, and who replaced them, and whatsoever, who bought who, and whatsoever. So at Faraday time, there was a paradox. But then time passes, and there was discovery of passivation, where the layer of metastable Fe304 forms a metal surface protecting it from corrosion at high concentration of nitric acid. So, talking about the second paradox, we say that electrochemical Faraday paradox was the result to the discovery of passivation, which explained the different corrosion behaviors of steel in diluted and concentrated nitric acid. talking about passivation, let me drop. The passivation mechanism in metals. Stainless steel 316, because there was a time when I had my metal lab or metal shop, but mostly for pleasure. So I had CNCs of various types, mills, lathes, and whatsoever. But anyhow, the nitric acid passivation removes free ion from the surface, promoting the growth of the thin, dense protective oxide layer, which maximizes corrosion resistance. The chromium oxide layer formed through the reaction with nitric acid protects the underlying metal from further oxidation and corrosion. So my question to you, it's a sort of stupid puzzle, but it is a puzzle. Okay, what about titanium? Does titanium oxidate? Back to you.
I don't know, Wesley.
Okay. So, the titanium, no, titanium doesn't passivate. The nitric and acid passivation for the titanium, at least I didn't found in the literature, but. It is known that titanium forms some form of natural oxide layer, which provides excellent corrosion resistance. So if we say about a passivation and forming natural oxide layer, what is the difference between two of them? Back to you.
Wesley, I'm sorry, but, I got my degree back in 76. I haven't really worked chemistry since then. I've been busy doing medicine instead. This is a little bit on the esoteric side. You can play the music all you want, I don't really care. Anyway, I really don't know. I guess it's an interesting puzzle for a chemist, I don't know. It's a little bit beyond my field of interest these days.
Okay. I understand that. I'm not in many subjects as well. Still requires chemical passivation to enhance corrosion resistance. where the titanium natural oxide layer provides some sort of inherent protection. We're talking about paradoxes. I want to be a little bit humoristic. So we have electromagnetic induction and noise, the production of voltage by time-varying magnetic flux, that would be electromagnetic induction, can sometimes result in unwanted and usually random disturbances in electric signal noise, seemingly sort of paradoxical behavior. Another example of paradox will be wave-particle duality. we spoke about it so many times. But the really something that sounds like BS is electromagnetic fields and paranormal phenomena. And I was thinking, if we have a certain object on the table and we have a strong electromagnetic field that changes the temperature of that object, would that object move if it's a little slope like the cup with the hot coffee on the table, because the air bubble beneath that got compressed and hot between you?
Okay. I don't really see that as forces kind of every action is a reaction. The evaporative surface of a hot liquid, I don't think manifests as any significant amount of downward force. I mean, there might be an infinitesimal one, but it would be quite infinitesimal. Action, reaction. So you are moving particles up, so the coffee cup will probably want to go down.
Okay. So we have the last one. Not all electrical engineers understand impedance. But you can make an explanation that sounds much better on the technetor to voice, if you don't mind. So this is a ham radio related at some point, because we're talking about DC circuits, and we're talking about impedance at some point. Just to voice.
Okay, C2GSA. Again, I'm not quite sure what has to do with what. The principle that you tacked this thing onto was a guy who we talked about maybe a little bit less than a year, about what happens when you have a break in a circuit and you branch one transmission line out to a short and the other one to an open, what happens to current and electron flow and what have you. What exactly this has to do with impedance, not quite sure. You alluded to the fact that when you initiate a DC circuit, initially there's a transient point where it's very AC-like, and so impedance might have an effect on the first few nanoseconds of such a circuit, but after a few nanoseconds, that transient settles down and it all becomes DC. So I'm not quite sure why you wanted to discuss impedance in light of this. I mean, the circuit that he used to extend the time interval that would be picked up by his oscilloscope will manifest some degree of inductance and also capacitance. So I can't kind of tell you what the end result would be. Would it zero both out, or would it be a little bit more capacitive, the transmission line, or a little bit more inductive? So I'm not quite sure what the point would be.
So we have a loop of wire that is open at a certain point. It looks like a letter Y. So we have one wire going one way and coming back to the middle and going to the other side, making another arm of Y and coming back. And both of them are connected to 9-volt batteries. But if you look at the square signal has a leading edge and falling edge. And if you look closely at that leading edge and falling edge, they have a slope. And that slope is the AC. So when you first connect the battery, you do not have DC. You're not dealing with DC at all. You have AC to establish itself at some level of DC. So that ringing signal pattern dies. And then if we have AC, then any circuit or even a piece of wire on the table reacts with AC or with electromagnetic wave. Let me jump.
Wesley.
Go ahead.
It's not a piece of wire. It's twisted pairs.
Yeah, but it is a resonant circuit that is serious and parallel and could be seen as a complex impedance circuit. So it could be calculated based on the AC that is on it, not on DC. So after a few nanoseconds, you could see it as DC because everything that is AC on it dies out. Back to you.
Yeah, I said that about 4 minutes ago.
Right. So what I'm saying is, once we have AC, then we deal with the impedance. And the resonance circuit in resonance has the capacitive inductance and inductive reactance cancel out, leaving pure resistance on it. So this is the AC circuit, and since we have the open arm from one side, unterminated, we could connect, we could treat it as the coaxial cable or transmission line that is open at one side, and then the SWR is high, and we can measure with SWR meters the reverse power coming back to the source. The same story is with closed arm. If it's closed and there is mismatch of impedance, the signal goes down because it's AC. That's what I was talking about. Back to you.
VDH, would a comment?
Yes, please, John.
Okay, first of all, we're dealing with DC transients, okay? The transient pulse, yes, it has a rise time and it has a fall time and everything. That is not really considered AC, that is a DC transient. Inductive reactance, capacitive reactance, is only defined for sinusoidal conditions, okay, because the sine wave flowing in an inductor generates a current, a sinusoid will generate a voltage sinusoid, okay. If it is any other wave shape, then you have to go back to the first principles of inductance, that B sub L is L D I D T. It is only when you're dealing with a sine wave that when you take the derivative of a sinusoid, you get another sinusoid shifted 90 degrees in phase. So inductive reactance, likewise capacitive reactance, is only defined for sinusoidal states, sinusoidal conditions. The transients that you're talking about on a twisted pair, those are DC transients, for example, pulses. Yes, there is a reflection coefficient. For example, an open twisted pair will have a reflection coefficient of plus one. A shorted twisted pair will have a reflection coefficient of minus one. Okay, but any resistance in between will give you a reflection coefficient somewhere between those limits, depending on the characteristic impedance of that twisted pair. So you can't really talk about AC sinusoidal conditions with DC transients. But
thank you very much, John. Wes?
I have a question. to the gentleman because he was qualifying. If we would just cut off that which you call transient, cut off and start to repeat that. So we have a slope starting from zero to the certain amplitude, and we're cutting off, and then we're going back and repeating that signal. You would have the steady repeated pattern of AC in it. Would that constitute the resonant circuit with its own possible frequency of resonance and its harmonics, or it will not? Back to you.
Well, for example, let's say we took a battery, a 9-volt battery, and you hooked it up to a twisted pair, and you threw the switch on and off, connecting and disconnecting the battery. Okay, so what you're generating is a 9-volt positive going square wave. Let's say you turn it on for a half second, off for a half second. So you're generating a 1 cycle per second, half second on, half second off, 9-volt positive going only square wave. Okay, on that line you would get reflections. Okay, but those reflections would not be the kind of where the reflection coefficient could be a complex quantity. Put it that way, the reflection coefficient would be, if the line was open at the far end, would be +1. If the far end was shorted, that reflection coefficient would be -1, and that twisted pair of a wire, let's say it's 22 gauge wire, that twisted pair would have some characteristic impedance depending on its distributed inductance and capacitance. For example, I think twisted pair 22 gauge gives you a characteristic impedance of around 90 ohms. We'll give you around 90 ohms. Let me break. So that's going to give you the determine what the reflection coefficient is. For example, suppose you took a length of twisted pair, far end shorted, and let's say it was several meters long. But just to get an idea, let's say it was about 30, 40 meters long, far end shorted. At the near end, you put a scope across the terminals, and you put a 9-volt battery there. You will see the 9-volt jump positive until that leading edge of the waveform gets down to the far end, gets reflected by the -1 short circuit, and comes back as a negative going 9-volt, and that cancels out the positive going, and then you see the signal go to zero. So you see at the near end there, where you've connected the battery, like a 9-volt pulse that would last for the round trip travel time on that twisted pair of transmission line, because at the far end shorted, the reflection coefficient is -1. Go ahead.
Comment.
There was another comment, I believe.
Yes, comment away.
SHO here. Couple of questions, if you don't mind me inserting. You know, I'm just a technician. I try to learn whatever I can from the engineers. But one thing I'm not hearing talked about is the high-frequency components that are generated during that rise time. And if I understand it all correctly, the faster the rise time, the higher frequency those components. Are they not sinusoidal in nature, even though they are, tapering off, diminishing in amplitude over time after the rise time is completed? And two, where does the energy go when it cancels? I think I've posed this question to you before, Roy. When you have a cancellation in a scenario like that, where does the energy go? What happens? What is actually happening to make -9 and +9 return to zero? Is it heat? Is it something else? KC2, GS from KC2, SHO.
BDH, would comment?
Yes, please comment, John.
Yeah, well, when what happens is when that negative 9-volt step comes back, the battery now sees a short circuit. So where does the energy go if you took the 9-volt battery and just short-circuited it? It heats up internally in the battery, some of its series resistance. Leave it like that, and the battery kind of gets hot. So it's being dissipated in the internal resistance there of the battery. But until that negative step comes back, when you look at the near end there with a scope, you see the 9 volts go high, and then it goes back to zero when the reflected negative 9 comes back. And it's only until that comes back. Now, that round-trip propagation time, it'll be of the order of nanoseconds, maybe tens or hundreds of nanoseconds, depending what the velocity factor is. A good approximation for the velocity factor is around 66%. Of C. That turns out to be pretty much common for quite a few twisted pairs and also coaxial cable. It's only when you have open line you get higher velocity factors, closer to 80-90%. But pretty much that round trip time, depending on the length, is the length of time you'll see that pulse high. Now, as far let me drop. Now, it's true, yes, you're right, the leading edge of that pulse has high-frequency components in it. And what happens, they will get some distortion when you come back. It won't be a perfectly square when you come back. You might see some of the edges rounded off. But again, those are many different frequencies in there. So that's why you can't really speak of one inductive reactance or one capacitive reactance, because that's only defined for a single frequency sinusoid. So that's why generally when you're working with non-sinusoidal, often you have to go back to the first principles of the, you know, V sub L is LDI DT and I sub C is CdV DT. Yeah, they have to have that differential equation definition. Okay.
Was that handed off to
me? Yeah, John.
Real good. So I guess the short answer is they're not really sinusoidal, although they are high frequency. Correct me if I'm wrong there. They may have the shape. There's probably lots of ringing going on, I'd imagine, in a scenario like that. So it's something we work hard to remove from the pulse generation along the accelerator. And then, okay, so maybe that does answer the question I've had before, and that's what's happening in these self-cancellation circuits, you know, where they use, equal and opposite waveforms to cancel out things. So they have to design a circuit then to specifically absorb that energy. And then maybe it's getting off subject, but then I always wondered what happens when that happens in the airwaves when you get cancellation of electromagnetic spectrum. We can save that for another time. I've brought it up before. What happens then? Where is the quote-unquote short circuit? Is it a burst of energy, a burst of light? You know, what exactly is happening there? But again, we can save that for another time. KC2FHO, I'll go back to Luke.
I think ultimately a lot of these things end up in the emission of waste heat. If you have colliding sound waves that are completely 180 degrees out of phase with each other, they annihilate each other. The pressure wave kind of ceases to exist, and what you're left with is a residual kinetic energy increase of local gases, because energy can't be created nor destroyed, just change from one thing to another. Usually the ultimate waste energy is heat, kinetic energy.
Oh, one last comment, BDH.
Sure, John.
A good example of this, and I can't say enough praises about this video, on the ATT Tech Channel by Dr. Scheib, that similarities of wave behavior. He does just that example with his wave machine. He launches a positive wave one way and a negative wave the other way, and you can see as the waves pass through each other, the wave machine shows flat zero and as they cancel, and then they separate out, and you see the two waves go their separate ways. That video is worth 10,000 words, and it is a beautiful, even though it's from way back in the early 50s, I think, it is a beautiful video, and I think it would demonstrate quite a few of the questions people have about transmission lines. On the ATT Tech Channel. You got to look for it a little bit, but it's still up there.
Yeah, I put it on my link list maybe 6, 7, 8 months ago. So in some places it's there. If you do a just quick search for AT&T, it should pop up.
I was featuring the shape of the wire on the video that I was talking about. A coaxial cable that is connected to the splitter, but hardwired splitter. And there are two arms coming out of it, two pieces of coax coming out of it. One is short and one is open. And then we put signal, no matter what shape of signal. We have a sword shape or square shape, sinusoidal shape. As long as it has a leading edge and a falling edge, we have a changing, something that is changing, there's something that is not DC. If we do not have a properly terminated those two pieces of coax, we're going to have a return of the signal. And short would be coming back, and the open would be coming back, only if it's properly terminated. But a question to you, Dr. Roy. If you have a piece of coax and you have a splitter and you have two pieces of coax connected to that splitter, what would be the termination resistance that would terminate each one of those two pieces? Back to you.
Not quite sure what you're getting at. Well, what do you mean?
Okay, imagine that you have one piece of coax and 50 ohm coax. Now you connect to it a splitter and you create something like a letter Y, because to two ends of that splitter you're connecting two pieces of coax, also 50 ohm. And you do not want any return signal from that. And you have a terminating resistor. So the question to you is, would you put 25 ohms at each one of the ends of the two coax connected to that splitter and then connected to the coax that is connected to the transmitter? Or you put rather 50 ohms at each one? Back to you.
Okay, I'll kind of ask John to comment. I would assume it's weirder than that. You're putting two coaxial lines in parallel, not in series. So I think it's 100 ohms. Let's see, is it 100 ohms? I don't know. 100 ohm load on both sides should read as 50 ohms. At the bifurcation point, unless I got this completely wrong. John, what do you think?
Okay, a properly designed splitter, let's say a splitter back in the old days with cable TV, where you come in and you want to go to two different TVs, which are 75 ohm. A properly designed splitter will provide a match. In other words, you can come in with 50 ohm cable, let's say you're in a 50 ohm system, and you can go out with 50 ohm loads to each of the two dividers. That's if it's a properly designed splitter. Now, if you just parallel, let's say you take a piece of coaxial cable, 50 ohm cable, terminated with 50 ohm resistor, take another piece of 50 ohm cable, terminate that with a 50 ohm resistor, and put those in parallel. At that point, you have created a 25 ohm impedance point there. If you come in there with 50 ohm cable and just tie, you know, all center conductors together, all the braids together, you will have a mismatch at that point. Matter of fact, your reflection coefficient will be 25 minus 50 over 25 plus 50. That'll be your gamma, your reflection coefficient, because you see 25 ohms. Now, if you want to start playing around with quarter wave stuff and things like that, you can get other things that'll happen. One interesting case is, let's say you have a 75 ohm load. Let me drop. Let's say you have a 75 ohm load resistor on 75 ohm cable, and you want to go to 50 ohm cable, and you don't want to have any reflection at the junction point. Well, I could take a resistor of 150 ohms and put it right across that junction, and I will get a perfect match there. Why? Because the 75 in parallel with 150, if you do the math, product over the sum, you get, I think, pretty close to 50 ohms. So you get a match, but it's a lossy match, but you won't get any reflection off that point. You won't get any reflection from that. But a properly designed splitter, like a cable TV splitter, should provide a match in all directions. And in addition, it provides isolation from port to port from the two split ports. Go ahead.
Yeah, but I think Wesley is kind of talking, I might be wrong, more of if some sloppy guy used just a T-connector instead of any kind of thing that has a matching function.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, now we're talking just plain paralleling the cable, like with a T-connector, yes. Then if you came in with two 50-ohm cables that were each properly terminated to both arms of the T, and you tried to come into the center arm of that T, you would see a 25-ohm impedance at that point. Go ahead.
So you need to put 100 ohms on each one of the arms? Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying, let's say you had, RG58U terminated with a 50-ohm resistor, so it's properly terminated. Another length of RG58U terminated with a 50-ohm resistor, it's properly terminated. You come into each arm of a T-connector. At the input of that T-connector, you see 25 ohms impedance. Okay, so if you came in there with a 50-ohm source, you would have, at that point, set up a reflection coefficient of 25 minus 50 over 25 plus 50. That would be your reflection coefficient at that point, which I think is minus a third. You would have a reflection coefficient at that point of minus one-third. Go ahead.
What do you think, Mr. Wesley?
Well, I think John is right. I mean, theoretically, I think if you did 100 ohms on both of them, it would be very lossy. But I would assume that ultimately it would look like 50 ohms. Would that be the case, John, or not?
Let's see. Now, if you're terminating the line, if you're terminating 50 ohm line now with 100 ohms, now you have a mismatch on that line. Now the impedance is going to depend on the length. Let's say you make it a quarter wave of 50 ohm line terminated with 100 ohms, you're going to see 25 ohms looking in there because the quarter wave
length of line. It does Z0 squared over ZR. So if you, the 50-ohm line squared, that's 2,500, divided by ZR 100, that gives you 25 ohms. That's for the quarter wave. And the other length of line where you have a mismatch of 100 ohms on the end is going to give you some complex impedance, as you can see on the split chart.
What about a half wavelength?
A half wavelength, if you mismatch, it will give you the same impedance as the mismatch, because a half wave is once around the Smith chart. If you draw a circle on the Smith chart, you go around that circle once. That's a half wave. In other words, everything repeats every half wave. Everything repeats a half wave. Go ahead.
Okay, so it's pretty much a very complicated question that has complicated answers. So, Wesley, do you have anything more about this?
Yeah, for simple electronics for high schooler in Europe, you have a 200 ohms resistors and connect them in parallel, you have 50 ohms. But actually, yes, it is a little bit more complicated, and he's right. I agree with you. That makes sense.
Okay, very good. Thank you, John, so much. I really appreciate you sharing your expertise with us.
It's only because I'm teaching my transmission line course this semester, and I just gave the test number two, so similar to one of the problems that you're discussing. So I got Smith charts all over my desk here, so that sort of explains it.
Okay, very good. I mean, well, one of my my search for the ultimate teaching lesson is to figure out how to teach people some aspects of a Smith chart over a radio without any images whatsoever. It's another one of those things that I think it's very difficult to really teach the subject well with a couple of illustrations. So with no illustrations, I wouldn't begin to know how to begin.
There's a formula for the Zn given the Z0, the characteristic impedance of the line, and the terminating impedance. And in class, I refer to it as the big nasty formula. It goes something like Z0 cosine beta L plus JZR sine beta L, and then just the opposite in the denominator. And if you really want to make it nasty, the sines and cosines go over the sinches and coshes, hyperbolic sines and cosines, if you have lossy lines. So it will really give you a nosebleed. That's why the Smith chart is so beautiful. It takes up that big nasty formula and puts it in a nice, easy to understand graphical form, and really a beautiful graph.
Yeah, John, I have a question for you. You say you just had the lessons from the Smith chart. Are you the young guy in the university, or you are just the guy who takes the lesson because he wants to?
No, I'm faculty in the electrical department over at SUNY Farmingdale. I'm in my 50th year, so retirement is creeping up on me. My wife talks my arm up to about 40 foot pounds and says, you got to retire. And I'm still having a lot of fun. Plus the fact we just got over $1 million of Rode and Schwarz equipment in a new RF lab, so can't retire.
Okay. I believe I finished for today, but there is something that I would like you, John, to do. It takes 5 minutes. Is being called a fork, and this is it is made for two diodes. I'm trying to get to this email that I sent to Dr. Boy. Hold on. It's called Avramenko fork. In other words, it's a transmission of energy to one wire and no other wires needed to close the loop. Of course, the loop is closed, but that's more to explain. It's going to be probably next week if I have a time for it. So you're connecting one diode one way and the second diode opposite way. You're putting those two pieces, two ends of it together, twisting it, and you connected it to the input of the voltage. Between the other two ends, you put the load. And that could be your 50 watts incandescent light bulb, or could be a resistor, whatever. Are you going to have energy dissipated on it? It takes you 5 minutes to do it. And you can also search for Avraamenko fork. Now, it is a subject that scientists do not want to talk to it about it much. The patent was filed in 2001, if I remember correctly for it. And actually, the patent was received, was approved in 2001, but it was filed in 1991 or 1993 by Avraamenko. So Avraamenko fork, sometimes they call it Avraamenko fork. But it works. It has a solid physical basis on it, and it's not a joke. Back to you.
Wesley, could you spell that? I'm not sure. I can understand. I'm not sure I understand what that is. You said something about two diodes. I know I've seen a circuit where they have two different light bulbs, and they are able to turn it on and each bulb on individually with a single switch. And I know there's some diode activity in there. But if you could spell that now, I'll see if I can get any information on it. Go ahead.
It's not going to be easy. I mean, spelling is easy, but it's not going to be easy for you to find that information. Avraamenko, Avraamenko, fork, F-O-R-K. So, this one is much more fascinating than that video that I was talking about, and you can make it in 5 minutes at your homes, and it works. One wire connected to two diodes having the other side load connected between the two other ends of those diodes. If it is a light bulb acting as a load, it will give you light. It could be 100 watts, 110 watts, 50 watts light bulb, or the small one. No second wire is required in the circuit, just one wire and two diodes, like a letter Y. Now, the Avraamenko fork requires much more time for understanding, but it's easy. I sent to Dr. Roy the schematic of connecting of those two diodes. So in 1993, the Russian duo Stanislav and Konstantin Avraamenko, Stanislav and Konstantin Avraamenko, Avraamenko, filed for the patent. The patent title is Method and Apparatus for Single Line Electrical Transmission. I repeat, Method and Apparatus for Single Line Electrical Transmission, which was granted to them at August 15, 2000. August 15, 2000. Back to you.
Leslie, remember that patents do not prove anything. You can patent something that doesn't work. It's not. It doesn't violate the rules of the patent office.
That's why I told you. Takes you 5 minutes, Dr. Roy, to see it on your own eyes. It's two diodes, nothing more. A power source and two diodes, and a load. You can connect between the two ends of the two diodes that are in reverse. Also, the capacitor in parallel with the load, and it's going to work. It's not a joke. I did it so many times, and you can do it too. And our friend could do it too. So find it, do it, and then tell us if it works. And to see it.
Well, John, apparently Wesley has given you an assignment. I don't know. I came up with four videos on the subject. One of them is in Russian, and the title is Free Energy, which gives me a rash. So I don't know what to make of it myself. I really didn't take a good look at it. They talk about resonant circuits and all kind of such things, and it's very reminiscent of the bad old days when I was dealing with people with free energy claims and such. So it's up to you, John. If this is Mission Impossible. If you wish to take this mission, if you get into trouble, we will not vouch for you. You have to be on your own. Okay, John?
Okay, fine business. Funny you mentioned that, I just saw Mission Impossible comes on MeTV Plus 6 to 7 and 7 to 8 channel 84. But that's another story. Okay, yeah, I'll look around and see what I can find. I have access to the library up there, so I can look at some of the older books there and see if I see anything. I'll definitely let you know. If I come across anything, I got the spelling, so I can search for it. Okay, yeah, I'll see if I can find something. Okay, back to Ned.
Yeah, I have a comment. That means if a guy interested in free energy, which is actually energy for free, because there is no free lunch, the sun is for free. The wind is for free. It is just a device that you use for it that you're paying for. So free energy is not for free. It's energy for free. And that's the difference. So if guy that is interested with energy for free, doesn't matter has academic background or has none of them, takes a pen in his hand. Is the pen then not existing or not working pen because he took it to his hand? I don't really understand the point of Dr. Roy. So if something that is questionable could be tested, actually in the patent there is a whole schematic in it and whole set of information about it. It is a transmitter and it's a receiver that was used for one wire energy transfer. One wire energy transfer. We would also say that Dr. Gobo, that is in Wikipedia, that made one-wire energy transfer using a surface wave, didn't do it. But it's in Wikipedia, and it works, and it was confirmed that it works. I don't understand the point.
A comment?
Yes, John, just for a second, Wes, don't get upset. We have a difference of opinion. And for the most part, on your free energy forum, you guys don't talk about solar batteries. You talk about more esoteric stuff. But John, please.
Okay. I lost my train of thought. Okay. The whole idea of this, you know, free energy, it's there are some cases where it may look like you are getting over unity energy, but in actuality, you know, when you really look at it carefully, then there's always some little catch in there. Nature doesn't let you get away with anything, can I say. Okay, I'm going to turn it back to Ned. Maybe I can catch my train of thought again on the next go-around. Go ahead.
Over-unity doesn't exist. It's a BS. Perpetual motion doesn't exist. But energy has to be taken in some form and converted to another form. That's only what it works. Because the amount of energy in your universe is fixed. But there was somebody who wanted to make a comment.
Okay, I wanted to comment on G line.
Do so, John. Yeah.